listeners to people who need to say something. Is that all right? It's like, you know, if you'd come, I'd be happy to listen to you. One of the issues about being a male is that I have, and I don't know if I'm by myself, but I have a dominant gene that's labeled in that DNA gizmo, fix it. It's just a dominant fix it gene. You give me something, first thing I want to do is fix it. So Sandra denies that, and she, unfortunately she's here and going to counter this, but when I think I hear her say, what do you think I ought to do about something? Then I quit listening and start fixing it. Now in East Texas, that has no G involved in that. It's just you're going to fix it, fixing it. But that's not, more often than is the case, what she's really wanting to do. What she wants me to do is sit and be a good listener and don't fix it. And the way I found that out was when I would begin to give, I thought, infinitely positive and clear suggestions on how to fix it. It turned into what some would refer to as an argument. And kind of, you know, grabbing me by the shirt, at least metaphorically, and saying, just sit there, shut up. And listen, I don't need you to fix it. Well, then quit asking me, what do you think I ought to do about it? So that's one of our codes. She really doesn't want me to fix it. On the other hand, you may have people that are continuously calling you, inviting you into their life to fix it. Have any of those? Talk to the ministry training deals. One of the interview questions that you ought to ask when you go there, so if I take this job and move here, who are the first 3 to 5 people are going to call me? You know who they are, right? They're the ones calling you. Just wearing you out. So in part of doing counseling, there's a notion of learned helplessness. Learned helplessness. These are the people that call and want you to do all their life's decisions for them. And it's the old deal, if you give a man a fish, you've fed him for a day. If you teach him to fish, you've fed him for a lifetime. Now, there are situations where you really need to step in because they're death of a spouse and I don't know what to do. But if you're 15 years after that and still trying to do all of the things that the individual could do for themselves, you really have not been a blessing for them. So sometimes there's a rich tension between wanting to be helpful and just kind of taking over people's lives. Those of you that have worked in the benevolence area find those kinds of situations. It's sort of like the old tar baby from Uncle Remus. You know, you touch it, next thing you know, it's absolutely all over you. And we can put fancy names like codependence and things like that, but we don't need to worry about that. Well, I'm going to get out of the way, and Sandra's going to refer to the book, and there's some of these available in the back if you have any interest.
I want to talk just a minute and make sure that this microphone is loud enough. I don't have a real strong voice, but can you hear okay, even in the back? If you can't, great. That's wonderful. That's a first, actually. I work in a prison, a men's prison, and I can remember one morning one of my coworkers came into my office. And she said, I need to talk to you. My husband tried to kill me last night. Now, this is not an inmate. This is a worker in the prison system. So we had a nice discussion about her family not wanting her to leave him because he was having a hard time. He had lost his job, and her family was encouraging her to stay with him. And she wanted my advice on what to do. About 2 weeks ago, another coworker came in, and this may have been even in the headlines, but it was a situation involving her two daughters, and one of them was married, and there was all kinds of sexual torture and murder involved over a weekend. Her family were actually, those three people in her family, her two daughters and her son-in-law, were the victims and the perpetrators. And so I'm just saying all that to say I hope none of you as elders and church leaders, have people in your congregations come to you and drop those things in your lap. It's kind of hard to have good answers for those situations. But I do know that the church is a small part of the rest of the world. And any kind of situation you would find in what we call the free world, from the prison setting, anything you would find in the outside world, you are very likely or could possibly find in your congregations. And many of you know some very sad, very hurtful situations, and there are no answers for them. I want to talk a little bit about the book that Tom and I wrote called Prelude to Joy. There are some back there that we would love for you to buy. But let me ask, does anybody know the difference between a rider and a large pizza? A large pizza can feed a family of four. Riders don't make much money. So we didn't write this book to make a lot of money. We had ministers, we had elders, we had friends who worked in small congregations out in the middle of nowhere. Tom and I have been doing marriage workshops for years, and we'd have people say, "Do you have a book? Do you have some tapes?" And we always said, "No, we don't. We just kind of go and do our thing and speak." So we put a book together to serve several purposes. We wanted ministers who don't have resources readily available. They live in small towns. We wanted something that they could have on their shelf that would give them practical skills to walk with couples through a variety of marital issues. The information in the book is based on the topics that research has shown are the most important topics in marriages and families. That if you want to help somebody, you hit these eight areas or so, and you can do a good job of covering just about everything. So we took our personal experience, we took our training, the research we had read about, we put all of this into a stepwise book that you can easily walk with couples through. It gives them skills, it gives you skills, it has information in it, it's like a workbook. And we also have found it useful for Bible classes. If you want to have a study in your church and have maybe a Wednesday night class. And one of the things that was fun about putting it together, Tom and I started writing the book. And we used the couples at University Church to kind of be our pilot study. And they helped us develop this in a sense that we started out in our Bible class as being information givers. We were just up there as professionals giving out this information. And everything was pretty quiet, and, you know, they'd come and listen. Well, after about the third week of working on giving a chapter at a time, Tom and I started telling our own stories about where we've been in our marriage, the good things, the bad things, the funny things, and the couples just, all of a sudden, they woke up. They got involved. They saw us as real people. So as elders in the church, leaders in the church, you've had life experiences that you can share with the other couples in your congregation. And to use this little book as a way to walk through that and to mentor, to have skills to teach them, to have ways that you add your own story to what you're teaching, it's a great little tool that we hope will help you. I want to say a little bit about the premise that the book is built on. And I get the impression in our culture that couples would rather buy the Mars and Venus book, or they'd rather have some kind of a gimmick that's the hot topic of the day, something off of Oprah, maybe. Oprah called me, but I told her I didn't want to waste my time being on there. But our culture wants the latest hot topic, and they want something that's just going to fix everything, and they won't have to really make any change. Lots of women will leave something by the, or men as well, will leave a book by the bedside hoping their spouse will pick it up and read it. They're not going to do that. But as Christians, we know that bottom line, the difference between a good marriage, a wonderful marriage, a lasting marriage, even though there are going to be problems in all of them, God makes the difference. So this little book we wrote is very heavily weighted in the direction of what God says about how to treat each other. And even though the scripture may not say husbands and wives and parents and children, anything that talks about how to treat other people, God especially means first and foremost for our families and for our marriages. So we've used a lot of scriptures in our book, and that's probably why Oprah might not be very interested, but the book is based on six premises. The first one is that marriage can be a taste of heaven this side of eternity. In my opinion, we're already living our eternal life. And I know that's a big theological question that people debate all the time. But if we are Christians, we're already in eternity. And so in that sense, with home being a place of refuge, a place of acceptance and love and peace and joy, in that sense, I think God intended our marriages to be a little taste of heaven this side of eternity. And I think that's very doable and very possible. The second premise is that we are created in the image of God. And if we understand that identity, and Fred Aquino is probably talking about this morning because I have him quoted in here. And if you look on page 40, he talks about how God in human form, the incarnation, helps us as human beings reorient ourselves within the meaning of the image of God. God coming in human form lets us know what our destiny is, what our purpose is, and the idea that when we say, well, we're all human. You know, we make mistakes. And we say, well, we're all human. If we're created in the image of God, Christ was human. Jesus was human. And he didn't sin. So there's that idea that when we mess up, we're being less than human. And messing up and taking the excuse, well, we're just human. So I have a little leeway here. On the one hand, I want to say, yes, I know I can't be perfect, but that doesn't excuse me from trying to be as much like Christ as I possibly can. And the idea of being created in the image of God has got, if we really understand that and accept that and take that challenge, that has got to make a difference in the way we treat each other in our marriage. It's got to make a difference in the way our homes look. And people that we work with on a daily basis, the people in our congregations and you as leaders, people are looking to you for answers about how their life can be better. And so for us to have our act together and to realize that being created in the image of God does make a difference in what we do and how we treat each other, that's a very powerful thing. And the world doesn't really have that because they don't understand that whole concept. The premise number three is that joy, not happiness, gives marriage substance and quality. We live in a culture that wants to be happy. We think we're entitled to be happy. And if we're not happy, there must be something wrong, so I'm going to do something to make myself happier. And if that means finding somebody else in my marriage that's going to make me feel happy, then that's what I'm going to do. That's our culture. That's what our children are being raised in. But joy, you know, happiness is kind of a fickle friend. As long as everything's going their way, its way, or everything's going our way, we can feel happy. But when things are not going our way, when things are not like we want them to be, when hard times come, joy is an internal resource. Happiness comes from the outside. Joy comes from the inside. And joy is when we know the end of the story, or we know the rest of the story. Joy is the journey that gets us through. And lots of times we're going to be happy, but lots of times we're not going to be happy. And people who don't have that joy to fall back on, when they're not happy, they get desperate. And they do all kinds of things to bring, because if they're not happy, they think there's something wrong. Well, if you're happy all the time, there's something wrong, right? Right, wrong? So the idea that joy and not happiness gives marriage its substance and stability, and working through these steps with couples can help move them to a greater sense of joy that really is more wonderful than always having to be happy. I don't know if I'm making real good sense there, but the fourth premise is that emotions change last. Now, there are lots of different kinds of therapeutic concepts, lots of different philosophies of doing counseling and therapy. And Tom and I basically tend to be more behavior, cognitive behavioral. It's the kind of the idea of what goes through your brain affects how you feel. People come to you as leaders because they don't feel right. They feel bad. Their emotions are goofed up. Their emotions aren't comfortable. People come into a therapy session and they ask for counseling because they don't feel right. That's their first clue that something's not, you know, something's not good. I mean, they could live a particular kind of life and it feels okay. You know, they're going to do that for quite a while. But when it starts feeling bad, when the emotions aren't comfortable, that's when they come for help. Well, it's our premise that emotions are the last thing to change. Emotions are the hardest to change. But if you change what you're doing and you change what you're thinking, the emotions are going to follow that. So the whole idea of this little book, you know, guys, like Tom was saying, that I don't want to be stereotypic because there are women like this as well, but men tend to want something to do. If you have a couple and they're having marriage problems, the wife will be more comfortable sitting and talking them out than her husband will, as a general rule. Not always the case, but most of the time. So men just say, give me something to do. Give me something concrete that I can look at and see that I'm actually accomplishing something. So we've written this as a workbook so the guys can have... This is written really with men in mind, y'all. Because men tend to be... We find that men tend to be more easily pleased with marriage than women. That's a blessing they have and a curse we have. But we tend to be more picky about relationships and we tend to want more from them. And men tend to be happier. So the idea that emotions, when we change what we're thinking and we change what we're doing, then the emotions come behind and we start to feel better. And one of the helpful things about working through this little book is it's full of behavior changes and thought changes and perspectives and changes of perspective for people. When people come for help, it's because they've done everything else they know to do and they've run out of options and they need an objective person who can look at the situation and give them better options or other options and help them choose what's going to work for them. It's not a matter of telling them what to do, because if it works, then they get no glory. You're the good guy. If it doesn't work, you're the bad guy and they're still in trouble. So having something for them to do and giving them different perspectives helps them for the emotion. They'll start feeling better. So premise number four is that emotions change last, and we may talk about rumination later, but premise number five is that love, agape love, is the essence of God, and the idea that true love is the essential nature of God expressed through action. Just because we don't feel comfortable or feel loving all the time toward our spouse doesn't mean we don't love them, and it doesn't mean we aren't loving them. Because the idea of agape love is a verb. It's a behavior. It's something we do. I had a couple come into my office when I worked at University Church. a police officer and his wife. And as we do at the beginning of any kind of therapeutic relationship, we always ask, well, how do you want to be different? When therapy's over, how do you want to be different? What do you hope to accomplish by this time we spend together? And the husband said, well, I want to love my wife more. And I think what he meant was he wanted to feel differently toward her. But when they talked, he was jumping through hoops, doing things. Whatever she asked, he was trying so hard to meet her needs of what he thought, so she would feel loved, basically. And as we talked about what love really was, she could see and he could see that he was loving her with his behavior. Because love is treating each other the way you want to be treated, being kind. Anita Bryant was asked one time about what her husband's favorite form of foreplay was. And she said kindness, that her husband's favorite form of foreplay was kindness. And so those kind behaviors, respectful, treating each other the way you want to be treated, can go miles and miles toward being loving and helping those feelings change as well. Number six, the last one, before everything fails, just read the directions. In our opinion, the directions are not so much in this book or any other one, but the directions are in Scripture. God tells us exactly how to treat each other and exactly how to treat people who aren't treating us well. And so from our standpoint, trying to help couples walk through this interesting journey called marriage is, we can't do it perfectly, and they need to know we can't do it perfectly, and they won't do it perfectly either, but that doesn't mean it's the end of the world. I want to just say one thing that on page 28, we ask couples to at the beginning, if they aren't praying together, to start praying together out loud. If guys have not heard their wife's prayer, they've really missed a treat, because women don't pray out loud very much. And so that's a special thing. But also, on page 28, we ask them to have a kiss that they have every day in their marriage. To kiss the kiss. I audited two semesters of systematic theology with Fred Aquino and thoroughly enjoyed it. So I know just enough theology to be dangerous. But in the readings, I, of course, couldn't help but read the church fathers years and years ago through the eyes of a family therapist and a psychologist. And I found this wonderful reading. It says, "Receive thee one another, and let us kiss one another. Think not that this kiss ranks with those given in public by common friends. It is not such. For this kiss blends souls one with another and solicits for them entire forgiveness. Therefore, this kiss is the sign that our souls are mingled together and have banished all remembrance of wrongs. This kiss, therefore, is reconciliation, and for this reason, holy." And that is from the Lectures on the Christian Sacraments by Saint Cyril of Jerusalem in the 4th century. But as I read that, I thought, would it not be fabulous if every marriage had a kiss like that? The world never heard of this kiss. And I had neither till I read this. I mean, we've heard, the Scripture talks about a holy kiss, but we don't know much about that. But the idea that, and we had a little couple came down after we talked about this kiss. Well, the next week they came down and they said, we have a question about that kiss. Okay. We don't know is it supposed to be like a peck on the cheek, or is it supposed to be a kiss on the mouth, or a kiss on the hand? What's this kiss supposed to look like? And that started me thinking, you know, what does this kiss look like? And it dawned on me that this particular kiss doesn't have, like, I don't have to walk up to Tom and say, I'm going to plant this kiss on you to banish all remembrance of wrongs and everything that you've ever done to me, so we're to mingle our souls together. That's not the idea at all, of course, as you know. But the kiss, this holy kiss, is more for me as the giver of that kiss than it is for the recipient. The recipient, you know, that's great. You say, I'm going to kiss you with a holy kiss. And it can look like anything you want it to. But just the whole idea of, when we talk about praying together out loud, if you know at night or sometime during the day you're going to be praying out loud with your spouse, it's pretty hard to keep a grudge, to hold a grudge, or pretty hard to stay angry and be mean and ugly to each other when you know you're going to be taking each other and walking together to God's throne. So that the kiss is just that whole idea of we're in this to the end. God created us brother and sister first, and then we're husband and wife. Being able to use those kinds of concepts to help our young families so they can do it sooner than we did, and give that information to their children early on, that's the best kind of premarital counseling those little ones will ever have. Just the idea of watching mom and dad live together because they're in the image of God, and to have the skills to be able to do that that they wouldn't have had otherwise. So that's just a beginning for what we're going to do.
If they'd come up and asked me, I'd have told them there's three kisses, and you can take one of these. This is a supplement to your handout. There's three kisses. There's a lip handshake. That's hello, how you been? Man, I'm glad to see you. There's at our house. I can't leave the premises without kissing her goodbye. I've actually been in the car halfway around the block, come back into the garage, gone into the house, kissed her goodbye so I could leave, so that I could actually get back into the house later at some point in time. So there's, you know, kind of that lip handshake. Salute one another with a holy kiss, which we don't do. We do a holy handshake because it's probably more sanitary. But in a marriage, there's those kinds of kisses. There's also on the other end of that the follow me down the hall kiss. It's the kiss with strings attached. It's the kiss that she'd complain, the only time you ever pay any attention to me is when you want to have sex. And he'd be like, well, okay. And there's a part of this notion that there is what I call a tweener. It's not a lip handshake, and then there's not one with strings attached to it. It's an embrace that says, well, I came in the house not long ago after a day, and I just sort of picked her up and gave her a big hug and put one on her, had no strings attached to it, and I said, I'm so glad you love me and I love you, and I can't tell you how glad I am to be home. Kiss. So those kinds of things. Now, when the things that Sandra's talked about is kind of sort of extramural from the handout. We're going to go through the tab 6, not point by point. What we tried to do was put more information in there than we could ever get covered in 2 hours, and put it in such a way that it was discernible to you or somebody that wouldn't come into this class on a bet but would read tab 6 in the privacy of their own home. You know, they're off thinking theological things. But the phone call, I think, is going to be more practical, you know. Louise has left. What do I do? I haven't even looked up the stuff Randy was talking about in that first joke he did about the pre and post stuff. I don't even understand that. The handout that I've given you is a supplement for your attendance. So if you don't show up, you didn't get one of these. And I want to talk about listening and speaking. And I put them in that order on purpose. In the ad on the web, it said session 1 would have some things about communication. When you look at tab 6, the first handout that's in the top 10 things that are wrong with marriages, the number one thing that's wrong with marriage is communication. Now, this afternoon, or if you come back, or if, as you take that home with you, those are in an order from the most common problem to the least, and the top 10. So people come into you, they're going to say, we have a failure to communicate. We want to learn to communicate better. More often than not, what they mean is, when I talk, you don't agree. Now, there are times when the skill system breaks down, and we're going to work a little on that under this notion of listening and speaking. But since you can, I know it's not good grammar, you cannot not communicate. It's impossible to not communicate. You remember when your kids were little and you had all this noise upstairs and you yelled up the stairwell and said, what are you guys doing? And they said, nothing. You knew they were doing something. You just weren't quite sure, but they weren't going to give you more information than, than they really thought they could live with. So there's this notion that there are not only verbal kinds of communication, but there are nonverbal kinds of communication. Your body language, the facial expressions. I was doing a delivery to academic department chairs. That's a whole group of genre of individuals, probably like managers in your corporate structure. And this one guy was just, every time I'd, well, and here's the next thing you need to do. Never set out, so I just began to sort of address, well, I can tell that Dr. X is a little put out with this. Well, I didn't say that. preaching, you get a lot of that. You just look out and go, oh, I don't think I'm going to this side of the auditorium anymore. When I was, every once in a while, I would give a talk at Skillman Avenue when I was little bitty. There was a lady, dead now, hard of hearing, and about the time she got fed up with you, it was when the old, you had that big box, she'd kind of unbutton and go in and turn you off, and you knew she was through with whatever it was you were saying. It was just, that's it. Listening, I think, is the real skill that church leaders are hungry for. It's not so much that we need to go and talk and tell and inform people. Quite often, I think, our strategy is if something's broken, let's just do a series sermon about it, or a series of sermons. That'll cure it, right? An interesting thing about that we know from a lot of different deals is when a society fails to teach something from the ground up, like in the home, we have a tendency to write more books about it. If you're not getting the instructions, and it's just kind of common knowledge, we write more books about it. So, how many marriage books do you think are being written? Is it its own industry? Yeah, so we're missing what it is to live together as two selfish individuals who's married the other person to meet our personal needs and to get along happily for 60, 65, 70 years, right? And we think, well, that'll happen. We dated a lot. Now, on the congregational level, most congregations don't have marriage mentoring programs. We're going to talk, there's some handout at tab 6 about that. We don't really do things overtly to take, if you will, senior couples, people that have some clue, that are willing to be transparent, and pair them up with younger couples that are willing to have somebody besides their moms and dads that they can go to and say, how's this stuff work? Look what we're doing. We don't require in congregations, many ministers don't require, before they would do a marriage ceremony, that couples had some form of meaningful premarital counseling. Did, in fact, they have some clue what they were getting into? What are the skill sets? It takes more activity to go get a driver's license than a marriage license, right? Interestingly enough, in the state of Texas, when you get that marriage license now, they give you a set of instructions. Big set of instructions. It's, 25 pages or so. Doesn't mean you're going to read them. It doesn't mean anybody's going to ask you if you know it. But what you don't know is I helped write that. So one of the things that you can do if you kind of hang out and they're right enough, I couldn't get to do premarital counseling for all the people in the state of Texas, but I could at least help author most of what you have in tab 6 goes to everybody that gets a marriage license in the state of Texas. Now, some of them are getting their third, fourth, and fifth marriage license, and so they have a collection, of these booklets. So let's talk about listening and speaking for a little bit. I want to run through this. I tried to write in complete sentences, and so we do want to do a little Q&A perhaps at the end. I think it takes more skill to be a good speaker than it does to be a good listener, even though we're starting with listening first. An older book called The Awesome Power of the Listening Ear kind of began to talk about this. Particularly it was used in pastoral counseling kinds of settings. It gained some popularity. It's kind of off the charts now. Nobody really thinks about it. But there's this big ear in a conversation, and there's this big mouth in the conversation. Now, those in the computer industry know about garbage in, garbage out, or those of us that have a computer know about that. I put garbage in, and I have no idea where it goes. You know, I push delete, and it's in Bolivia or something. But I'm being asked to be a good listener. And as a therapist, most of what I do is listen. That means I have to find a way to entice you as the client or the person that's come for my help to talk. And so the way I do that is learn to develop artful questions. And I can lead you wherever I want you to go by asking you really good questions rather than telling you this is what you need to do and sticking your nose in it, my opinion. So I want to be a good ear. I want to be receptive. I want to be empathetic. I don't have to be sympathetic, but I want to be empathetic. I want to create an environment where you feel comfortable coming to me and telling me whatever it is you need to do. Now, I found when I served as an elder that my phone wasn't ringing off the hook with people asking me questions. Have you noticed in your congregation that since we don't do much screening, that if you had, let's say, 1,000 in your congregation or 250, you'd have a fair cross-section of the general population? You got some sane people, you got some crazy people, you got some demented people, you've got some addicted people, you got alcoholics, you've got, you got it, and they're out there. You got people with great marriages, you got people that got stinking, you got some really nice folks, and you got a few old soreheads. And they're all there on Sunday, and you're responsible for them as a shepherd. And quite often, they're doing things that you, as I said at the beginning, you have to come back in and help them clean up the mess. I like a lot of metaphors, and my notion of that is they got a hand grenade, pulled the pin, played with it, it went off, and not only they, but a lot of innocent people had shrapnel. Just think about you're in a Humvee driving on the airport road in Baghdad, minding sort of your own business, and all of a sudden, kaboom, here you are. And there will be times when people will call you and they are the innocent victims of the thing going off. They didn't get a vote either, but now it's impacted them. So let's look at being a good listener, but let's start with a poor listener. A poor listener rejects the speaker's words as uninteresting. I already know that. Come on, well, you know, what's next? Too simple or too complicated. We lived and worked for a while in Detroit. You can tell we lived in Detroit because I didn't call it Detroit, but it's Detroit. And then we moved to Greenville, Texas, and you know where Greenville, Texas is. Now, you come from Detroit Yankees to Greenville, Texas. Okay, spit it out. Let's go on with it. So I have to be attentive. I need to make good eye contact. I need to look like I'm listening. And you can tell if you're listening because usually this isn't moving. It's like, well, okay, and they're the one doing the talking and you're doing the listening. Number two, attend to the aspects of the speaker's manner and appearance rather than the words that are being said. Now, you can fudge with that a little bit. Part of what I try to do in therapy is I want to make sure that I'm getting the message is coming from the way they look and talk and all these kind of sort of nonverbals. Are they disheveled? Are they looking at depressed? Are they inebriated? You know, those kinds of things. But instead of being off over here simply paying attention to that, I need to be aware of the words that are coming through. There's an older, not really done all that much now, therapeutic modality called client-centered. was early trained in that. Now you can tell people that do that because you'll say something, and they'll go, so what I hear you say, that's Rogerian stuff. But in that, what you learn is, let me look at each one of these words. It's really difficult to unpack all of those words. It takes a lot of skill because I'm looking for, as when Sandra was talking, I'm sort of looking for words that help me understand what they're thinking. Have you ever been had somebody come and tell you a story and the first thing you wanted to do was just, what were you thinking about? You know, nothing. Now, that's just your children, right? That's what they used to do. At one point in time, you were a kid, and you probably got to give that answer to your parents. I had a real nodal experience. I was raised over in Lake Highlands, just off White Rock Lake, and got off early from Gaston High Junior High one day, and there was snow, and mother worked, and it was good snow. Wet snow. You can make a really good snowball. And I saw Sister McDermott coming down the road in her car, and I hid behind a cedar bush and just blasted the driver's side door. I mean, it was a good one. Well, she started honking her horn, rolled down the window, and started yelling. So I cut down the alley, went in, came in the back door. Much to be surprised, my mama had come home early and was interested in me. She knew when the bus would be. That she had been on the front porch. Tom. Hi, Mom. How come you threw that snowball at that lady? Well, we had physics today, and I was looking at the compaction ratio of ice crystals and the trajectory of, I don't know. So sometimes when we ask dumb questions, we get dumb answers. What'd you do at work today? When we lived in the Detroit area, actually Pontiac, we had a deacon that worked at the Pontiac Company, and for, I think, the 7 years prior to this incident, every day, all shift, he put rearview mirrors on Pontiac-type automobiles, GMCs and things. Put rearview, that, he was just that kind of guy, and he enjoyed that, and he was good at it. He came in because he was perplexed. You know where this is going. He would come in, sit down for dinner, and across the roast beef, his wife would say, "Well, hon, what'd you do at work today?" Rearview mirrors. You kind of get that guy thing going there. But the women know that was code for, I've been stuck with these three-year-olds, could you use sentences that have larger words and just kind of tell me what it's like outside of these walls, right? I mean, it wasn't, but it came out, what'd you do at work today? So we have to attend to the verbal message, that digital part. Stop attending, if we're not listening well, we stop attending to the overall message and we concentrate, get lost on a particular word or phrase. So while we're looking at these little pieces, we need to be able to look at the big pieces. Now, and number four is we know in advance what they think we're going to hear. That's a poor listener. We kind of, I know where this is headed, and I turn it off about the third word. One of the things that our elders do at University Church, and I've actually never gotten enough courage to respond to the invitation and go to room 101. That's where the elders wait, lurk, I think. And you know, we never know. I think if you go to 101, you ought to have to go dead center first in front of the pulpit and then turn right to go to one. You know, sneaking out the side because I need to pray for you. I need to know if you've messed up last week. So they come in there, and I'm talking to them. How far into their confession do I quit listening? How far into what they're going to say? To what extent am I sympathetic? Am I sympathetic to how much courage it took them to make those steps to get to 101? I mean, I don't know. But part of my listening would be to be empathetic to the courage that it took to tell the story. I think one of the reasons that we don't really confess our sins to one another so much is I'm not sure what you're going to do with that. Your sin may be gossip. I want to ask that first. But are you going to condemn me? Are you going to listen to me? Are you going? You don't have to say, well, don't worry about that. Or how in the world could you do that? And one of the reasons our ministers don't have anybody to confess to other than their therapist is they don't know what's going to happen to that. They don't know what's going to be the repercussions of that. And so they live in isolation and go in tailspin, and we go down and clean up after there's been a big wreck somewhere. Well, let's look then at speaking. And these would be the kinds of things then that not only that you would do, but we're going now and thinking about, all right, I'm trying to talk to somebody in a marriage and they're having problems with communication. Well, one of the reasons I put this the way it is, and if you want a clean one, I think there's probably enough left that you could make copies of this and just give it to them. You know, think of it as bibliotherapy. So, well, I gave you Milholland's handout. How come you're not better? I don't know. But I put these down in terms of speaking. These are the things that good speakers are going to do. Number one, they're going to use the I rule. I'm going to use I statements rather than you statements. You statements have one of these kinds of things. They're accusative. People become defensive. They kind of quit listening. They start making up their rebuttal answer when it's a you statement. But if I'm a good speaker, I'm going to take personal responsibility for what I'm saying. Think about a business meeting, elders meeting, church meeting, whatever it is. Is somebody doing you stuff, or are they doing I kinds of things? I also put in a phrase about it statements. If I do, well, you know, I don't know what's wrong with it. Now, what you hear more often in congregations is them and they statements. Give you, at one point in time when all my hair follicles were working, it was a little longer than it is this morning. And I had a little more hair on my face. And one of the elders came up, and I was preaching at this place, and one of the elders came up to me and said, you know, a lot of people come up to me, and they're concerned about your beard. Now, what did I know about a lot of people? Bill and his wife were pretty torqued about that. And they were hiding behind a lot of people. And I knew that, but I was younger and kind of being feisty, and I said, well, I think it's only right and fitting and biblical based on book, chapter, and verse that you let me know who they are so that I can go to them since they have aught against me. Well, I promised confidentiality. I said, well, why don't I just start with you and your wife? Now, that could have been a moving conversation. What I found out was he actually gave up the treasurer. The treasurer was torqued about that. He was kind of bent out of shape. And the treasurer's philosophy was, if I'd grown the beard before the budget went out, I wouldn't have gotten a raise. But I waited until after they gave me the raise to grow the beard, which wouldn't have purchased a razor. So I called the treasurer that day. This was Sunday morning. I always wait till Sunday morning. So I called him right after lunch, and I said, I need to meet you prior to services. What's it about? I'll tell you when you get there. I want him to worry just a little bit. Came in, he said, well, he said, you know, have you noticed that since you, and I'll hush about this, but he said, since you've grown the beard, the contributions just dropped way off. I said, yes, you're exactly right. Now, this is Lubbock in January. We'd had 3 sleet storms and a holiday. I thought, I kind of liked that I had a sort of a Samson-esque powerful hair follicles that I could stop the budget. And you want to know, I shaved it off because it bothered him, and I'm not trying to get points for that, but I'd take them if you gave them to me. But as soon as I shaved that off, the sleet storm stopped and the budget went up about March and April. It was wonderful. But sometimes you have to do those sorts of things. They take responsibility. Let's look at number 2, the statement rule. Self-expression should be in the form of statements rather than questions whenever possible. Well, what do you think we ought to do about those fill in the blanks? That's a question. But it really is underneath the kinds of things that people are saying to you. When I was thinking about this, I went back in my memory to the kinds of things that come our way as church leaders. The marital problem things are fairly easy, but I think you wind up providing counsel just to those kinds of comments. Is that making any sense? Okay, obviously not. When you're in the foyer or when you get the phone call and people are, remember, you never get usually the comments or the phone calls of praise and adoration. You're usually cleaning up the mess from what the preacher said, you know, or, you know, somebody's torqued. It was early, the phone rang. And we had changed this was at Skillman, we changed the pew, the Bibles in the pew from the King James to NIV. My. Brother Mel Holland, I was the youth minister. Well, they weren't about to, they weren't going to call John Bannister the golden throat of Dallas, right? They're going to nail the new kid. I don't know what John would have said, but don't you know that if the King James Version was good enough for the apostles, it ought to be good enough for us? And see, that's a question. And I wanted to give him the answer. But what I knew was he was upset with change, right? You know, it may not be translations anymore. It may be PowerPoint instead of the book, or it may be who knows what. You know, we've got two microphones going simultaneously, and I'm sure that violates some Koinonia principle. And, you know, I don't know. But it's always going to be. But if I'm a good listener, preaching in Lubbock and do a responsive reading, which now is kind of commonplace, but I knew every time we did a responsive reading, the same lady would catch me at about the same time in the foyer, and she would say, not with love in her heart, thank you for that Catholic service. I would say, you're welcome. Making statements. Questions prevent the speaker from having to take responsibility for what he or she says. Under C in the say, ask, how, let me just say that if you make who, what, when, where, and how question statements, you'll get a why. If somebody asks you a why, don't try to answer it. Why did my spouse leave? Why did my marriage fail? Why? Well, let's say you had the absolute best dead-on answer and you give it to them. All they have to do to discount it is say, well, I don't think so. On the other hand, well, I think your spouse left for the following 15 or 20 reasons. They don't need to hear that either. But you can fold that back is, what is it about that that you think led to that, or how are you dealing with that? So who, what, when, where, and how, I think, always give you a why. D, keep it in the present. Keep it present-oriented. Don't let them run off and chase rabbits up and down the line. And then E, simplicity speaks the truth. It's important that self-statements be made direct, open, honest, and free of any verbal excess. You say, well, that's an awful lot of stuff. How do I incorporate this? I would think that a good start would be today and tomorrow and the next few days, practice the way you make these kinds of statements. Tell your spouse, I got this stuff, I need to practice. Let me see if what I'm saying is working. Listening is a little bit easier. Let's just look quickly at request making. Request making is two types: framing the request properly and appropriate timing. You'll have folks come in, and one of the things that they'll want to do is, well, we worked on our marriage until 5:30 this morning. We started about 10 o'clock. I hope you'll say, oh, I'm so sorry. You can tell couples don't fight or discuss about their marriage while they're laying down in their bed. If it's going to go south, let it go south around the kitchen table. I had a couple the other day. I said, well, if you guys fight real good, what I'd like for you to do, instead of doing that in the bedroom, I want you to go in the garage. Don't turn on the car, you know. It's still warm up there. We don't want anybody, you know, done in. But sit in the back seat of your car and have these discussions. Well, I'd feel pretty stupid doing that. Kind of matches the level of your argument, you know. Breaking up some of those sequences. So the part that I'd want you to also underline, and there I'm running out of time, is Listen for when people say, I want or I need. I want or I need. And if I really want to leverage you and make you do something, I'll say, well, I need this. Can I do it? We're 2 weeks into moving my wife's folks from 25 years of being in one house to less than a week of being in, as my father-in-law calls it, the home. And when we were taking 12 rooms of a house to 750 square feet of home, I kept hearing again, well, I need this. I just got to have that. I need this. I need that. And so I'll confess in front of you, I went from therapeutic fibbing to ball face lying as we loaded the truck to bring it to Abilene. No, you don't need that. So the need part quite often is want. Think back to your kids when you're buying school clothes. Rather than just say, you know, here's $100, and when it's gone, you're done. It'll cut down the need-want stuff. So we don't usually think about that, but when we're listening to the way people are speaking and they need, I need, I need, versus I want, I understand I want. I want a lot of stuff. There's a whole lot more on my want list than there is on my need list. Then I've given you some feedback kinds of things. Just make a note that feedback and reinforcement are two entirely different concepts. Reinforcement, more often than not, is in that positive and negative, stop that, start that, this is good, that's bad. Feedback, as outlined here, is what you do to share that meaning back with somebody. And so here's the key, and we'll do a little bit more of this afternoon. When someone speaks, the listener is taking that in and should be, if it's a shared meaning, able to give part of that message, a concise clarification of that message back to them. Sometimes it'll sound like, what I hear you saying is this. You can also add what emotions they have. So when you do this, you're thinking about that and feeling that. It's real easy on the one hand, but it's difficult to pull together in 30 minutes worth of stuff. You want to close this out?
I want to say one thing, that if in being people helpers and mentors, elders, leaders of congregation, we know that it's not about us. It's about how God can use us to minister. And if you want to do, most of the time when people come to you with problems, all they need to do, the most helpful thing, is for them to be able to articulate it, verbalize it, have someone listen to them. And if you can reflect back to them, not so much what answers to their problem or what they need to do or what they've said, but if you can let them know that you understand the emotion behind what they're experiencing, then they'll know you've heard them. And that'll do more than anything to help them feel better, because they have their answers. They may need a little more walking with them to find them. But just the idea that when we tell someone the struggles that we have, if we know they understand the emotions that we're experiencing, there's something magical about that, that we think, we know we've been heard and we've been understood when somebody can reflect back that they understand how we're feeling. So that's a very simple thing to learn to do. Yeah. You don't have to be very
understanding
smart
is not synonymous with agreement. And I'd rather you would agree or disagree with me based on understanding rather than on a misunderstanding. Thank you, and thank you for staying the 3 minutes. Sandra will be back at our Kool-Aid stand if you're
The books are $20 a piece. If you want to take one for your church library, if you have children getting married, it's cheaper than a toaster.